This is Billy Brim and the voice of One Witness Radio broadcast coming to you today from Prayer Mountain in the Ozarks near Branson, Missouri. In this 234th birthday month of our great nation, how thankful we are to be here and enjoy freedom. I have been on, as I've been telling you all the week, a tour. It began at the end of June, and for 2 weeks with David Barton and Dr. Jim Garlow, we toured all the places of the founding of our great nation. Not all the places, but many of them. Boston, Plymouth, the battlefield, Monmouth, others. We saw where the blood is on the pew of William Tenet's church, where a young revolutionary soldier died. And many other things along the way that so spoke to our hearts. The size of the ship the pilgrims were on, the Mayflower. They have a Mayflower too built, and you can go onto that ship, and you can hardly realize how people lived for that length of time and came to this nation. And so we're using for a verse this week. Jesus appeared, of course, the risen Lord in Revelation to John on the Isle of Patmos. And he wrote to seven churches of Asia. And to the church at Thyatira, he said in verse 25, "That which you have, hold fast till I come." Brother Hagin used this verse to teach on holding your healing, how to keep your healing, as a little mini book we wrote on it. He said, "Why do you have to hold fast to something? It's because someone is trying to get it away from you. Who's trying to get away your healing from you? Satan. Who's trying to... If God founded America on godly principles, and as we heard yesterday from John Adams, that the birth of our nation is even tied symbolically to the birth of our Lord. Who doesn't like this? Satan doesn't like this. So he's trying to get it away, and he has waged a warfare, which has been going on for a few years now. So we're going back this week, last week, and we're looking at, with David Barton in his book, America's Godly Heritage, we're looking at what we had in the beginning from our founding fathers, and then how it's trying to be robbed away from us. So, John Quincy Adams, we read yesterday, tied the birth of our nation to Christian principles in an indissoluble bond. Now I'm taking up with David Barton's words again. Ironically, today's ivory tower elites assert just the opposite. They wrongly claim that the founders did not want an indissoluble bond, but rather that they wanted a so-called separation in order to keep biblical principles out of civil government. Fortunately, however, the founding fathers' own records document their steadfast conviction that Christian principles were to be preserved in the civil arena. John Jay provides a clear example. Now, that's one of the things that David Barton does. He goes back to the original documents, and he himself has a collection of many of them worth thousands of dollars. And of course, he knows where they all are, and he goes to the source. John Jay was president of the Continental Congress during the Revolution and was one of the three founding fathers who drafted and signed the peace treaty with Great Britain to establish America as an independent nation. After the U.S. Constitution was written, Jay helped pen the Federalist Papers and is considered one of the three men most responsible for the adoption of the Constitution. When George Washington became the first president, John Jay served as the first Secretary of State. And then he was appointed as the original Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Chief Justice John Jay, believing that Christian principles should be included in civil arenas, forcefully declared, quote, "Providence," that's what they called God out of respect, "Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it is the duty, as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation, to elect and prefer Christians for their rulers." President George Washington similarly urged the incorporation of religious principles throughout the public arena. In his famous farewell address, in which he announced to Congress and the nation that he would retire from public office at the end of his second term. And you remember that they really wanted him to go on, but he said, no, we don't want to have a king. We don't want to be like what we've come out of. We come and serve. Our peers come and serve, and then we go back to our places of abode. So when he wrote his farewell address, he offered candid advice on what it would take to keep America strong. For generations afterward, Washington's farewell address was considered so important and its content so profound that it appeared as a separate, standalone school textbook. Students were taught that this address was the most significant political speech ever delivered to this nation, and they were tested on its content. Regrettably, however, Washington's farewell address has now largely disappeared from current textbooks. Why? Oh, well, we can look all around us and see what's happening with secular-minded people, but you can know that Satan is behind it. Secularists today ignore and even attempt to suppress Washington's unequivocal declaration in that address as to what made the American political system so successful. Now we're back to George Washington's words in that address. Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars. You know what a pillar is? It's a big support. A tall, you can think of a Roman column or a Greek column or a pillar of support. And Washington identified the two most important elements of the American political system, the two most supporting pillars as religion and morality. He warned that anyone who attempted to separate those two elements from the political realm could not be considered an American patriot. America's system of government was deliberately and intentionally built upon religion and morality. It has subsequently enjoyed unprecedented success. America is now the world's longest ongoing constitutional republic. Bless the Lord. Political science professors believed that this question, what were the sources of the founders' successful ideas? In other words, we've got the most successful government. And what were the sources? It came from the ideas that came forth from the founding fathers. But where did their ideas come from? Well, there was a study done. Political science professors believed that this question, what were the sources of the founders' successful ideas? This question could be answered by examining a broad spectrum of writings from the founding fathers' era, with the goal of identifying their sources, the sources they cited in those writings. The researchers, and it was these are all published in a book, The Origins of American Constitutionalism by David S. Lutz, L-U-T-Z, and I believe it was printed by the LSU, Louisiana State University Press. So they set out to identify where did they get their ideas. The researchers assembled 15,000 representative writings from that period and isolated 3,154 direct quotes in their writings. At the end of 10 years, the researchers had traced the quotes back to their original sources, thereby identifying the most frequently cited sources of the Founding Fathers' era. The individual who was cited most, now they did it two ways. The individual, the person, who was cited most often in the writings of the founding era was a political philosopher, Charles Montesquieu, with 8.3% of the quotes taken from his writings. Legal scholar William Blackstone was next, with 7.9% of the quotes. And political philosopher and theologian John Locke was third, with 2.9%. These were the three most frequently cited individuals during the founding era. But the single most cited source was the Bible, with 34% of their quotes coming from the scriptures. Significantly, that percentage is even higher when you consider the source of the ideas used by the individuals they quoted, Montesquieu, Blackstone, and Locke. Consider, for example, a primary source of Blackstone's ideas. Blackstone's most famous work was his Commentaries on the Laws, first introduced in 1766. That's 10 years before 1776. It became the final word in American courts and remained a primary legal authority until well into the 20th century. A primary source of Blackstone's ideas is evident even through a superficial examination of his writings, but the testimony of Charles Finney also provides a clear confirmation. Finney, a university professor, educator, and civil rights leader, was probably best known as a famous revivalist during America's Second Great Awakening of the early 1800s. In his autobiography, Finney recounted his early desire to become an attorney. So like all other law students at the time, he commenced a study of Blackstone's commentaries. As Blackstone covered the various legal concepts, he frequently presented the biblical ideas on which the laws were based. Finney stated that in the process of studying Blackstone, he read so much of the Bible that he became a Christian and received his call to the ministry. So, that's clearly the situation. The Bible was a primary source of Blackstone, primary source of Montesquieu, primary source of Locke. So, the Bible was far and away the most influential source of ideas in the Founding Father era. I've often wondered, where are these great men today? They were great because they built our nation on the great truth of God's words. We know you're going to want this book, America's Godly Heritage, or the DVDs David Barton has prepared with wonderful pictures. Just call us at 1-800-972-3447 or go on billybrim.org. And don't forget, please be with us Wednesdays to pray for our nation. And in the autumn, as we gather in Branson, we must have an awakening. We must hold fast to that which we have. Thank you for the opportunity to do it, Lord. Shalom, everyone.